This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Charles Bernstein about the literary magazine Language, L-A-N-G-U-A-G-E, which Charles co-edited with Bruce Andrews from 1978 to 1981. Hi, Charles, how are you?
I am very well. Good to talk to you, David.
You as well. Well, this takes us back now many years, it being almost, well, it is literally 35 years ago that this began.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about, I think, the, you know, before we get to talking about how Language was established as a magazine, kind of how you see it fitting or arising, the impulse to publish the magazine. How that developed and what you felt you were doing, you and Bruce, when you started the magazine.
One thing you spelled out the letters of the magazine, because they're equal signs between the letters, and so we kind of created a logo. And the logo Language was to, you know, complicate the word Language in some way, and also to situate what we were doing in our magazine within a very lively set of discussions, often contentious, different points of view, but about what was the radical end and the innovative end of North American poetry in the mid-70s, coming after what's often called the New American Poetry, the poets that were collected in the Don Allen anthology that included the New York School and the Black Mountain poets and the San Francisco Renaissance folks and the Beats, who are pretty much a generation older than us. What distinguished our magazine, Language, from other magazines that were done by our immediate company was that it was a magazine of poetics. We thought, Bruce Andrews and me, who had both living in New York, not far from each other, that what we needed was a place where the discussions that took place privately and in letters could go public. In some ways, looking back in retrospect, it's a little bit, it's not a listserv, it's not a discussion group, it's not a blog, but it has many of the characteristics that became much more prominent in the last 10 years with the rise of poetry discussion groups on the internet. At that time, you would be very hard to find the discussions. They would take place after readings and in restaurants and bars, on the telephone, and in personal correspondence. I'm emphasizing that because while we were a magazine of poetics, we didn't publish long essays. They were not academic essays. They're not scholarly essays. We tried to do everything to less than 500 words. Which was a very strong characteristic, and we were obsessed, I would say, and I still am, with alternatives to traditional expository forms, journalistic forms, and scholarly forms, to keep the energy that would be going on in the poem also present in these prose works. So we wanted to open up the discussion, give a little light and air to it, and that's what we started to do with a wonderful essay by Larry Eigner. The great poet started us out in the beginning of 1978, six issues, $4. Issues were printed, were typed on my new Selectric typewriter, self-corrective Selectric typewriter, on legal size paper folded in half, so it was a half-lit size, so it was a side staple, a self-cover, I guess you call that, designed beautifully with no visuals of any kind, just all
no distractions.
By Susan B.
Right.
Her simple offset publishing, very much a little prior to desktop publishing. you don't mind if I talk about the details of small press, I hope. I know that that's something you were very interested in.
No, not that's actually...
People are, but I'm fascinated with the technology. So we come a little bit after the Mimeo revolution and the, you know, very much part of the Xerox style of that, although we did offset print the, you know, the pages, double-sided, on Regal with the saddle stitch, which is the staples in the middle. And we had a small subscriber list the first year. Maybe about 200 people paid that $4. Somewhere in the archives at UCSD, you have my handwritten list of everybody who subscribed and their address, because it was done that way. And then we physically mailed the stuff out. And then people kept subscribing and then wanting back issues and so on. So eventually, you know, we had a pretty, you know, a pretty good circulation for what that was. And then ultimately, Southern Illinois University Press published a selection, you know, 100,000-word selection of our of stuff we had printed, you know, about 3 years after we finished publishing the magazine. And that remains in print and actually still sells a fair number of copies. When I say a fair number for poetry context, you know, maybe, you know, in the 100 copies a year or something like that, still sells a language book. Even though the entire language magazine, the high resolution scans of the whole thing is available at a site that Craig Dworkin runs called Eclipse, including an index, Eclipse from the University of Utah. You can see every issue of language.
And what was the largest number of copies of an issue that you published?
It's hard to say because I went through different versions of them. I think initially we probably published around, probably the first issue, maybe we did 400. I think by the end, we were printing at least 1,000. Probably each issue, I would say the entire set had a circulation of maybe 1,500 over its lifetime, and for several years after, including reprinting and so on, and before, up to the time the language book came out.
And how many issues? But
the initial circulation was you know, 200, so 300. Because we also bring it individually to bookstores. So, you know, that's how partly we intersected in terms of distribution, which I learned a great deal publishing something, printing it, working with the design of it, simple as it was, and also bringing it to individual bookstores, following up with the bookstores and so on. But we didn't have a distributor. There wasn't any distributor that could have dealt with us quite at that time, although... that's another conversation. That's I'm very grateful for the places that do distribute small press material, but they became more prominent after our time. Also, we were somewhat eclectic. We weren't publishing books. We were publishing just this. It really was a new, would have looked to most people like a newsletter. By the way, I'm delighted that we spent this much time without actually talking about what the substance of the material was, what the view was, although it is partly related to what I'm talking about in terms of its form of distribution and the way we, you know, and part of the substance was just to have that kind of conversation at all.
And it wasn't, and sort of at that time, it seems like, especially for language, that it was a conversation between San Francisco poets and New York poets, principally, who were sharing similar outlooks and kind of conversational poetics. Am I right in thinking
there's
that?
There's no question that's right, fundamentally right. I'd want to include, however... It's right because, and this has to do with first of all, it was interesting just in and of itself that those groups of people, those locales might have been more separate, but we wanted, at least in New York, to make that dialogue more apparent and also to think of ourselves as working together. I always would say I have more in common with, you know, the people who are reading language than I do with other people I would see at New York readings and so on, that the sense of collectivity, community, or a shared commitment it wasn't geographic, and that trying to change the kind of exchange that we were having to make it not primarily local in the geographic sense is very important. That's what I say in some ways resembles things that become more prominent with the rise of the internet, where it's easier to circulate stuff. But as you know, it's a small, you know, I guess people say now micro-pressed, really micro stuff, such as we were doing, just getting it from one place to another in a speedy fashion required a certain amount of focus. It wouldn't happen otherwise, especially things like conversation, poetics, how what you were thinking about, what was a lot of the early issues of language, which we took out of the language book, but which you were extremely well well positioned to appreciate, were lists with addresses of magazines and book publishers that we liked. To constantly have lists in each issue, giving how to get steps of small press material. Otherwise, it would have been hard to find out what those magazines were. We listed some of the highlights of each issue, some of the contributors. However, I think that the geographic, because San Francisco and New York were the main centers of alternative, non-conventional poetry in the United States, and San Francisco, from what kind of stuff I was interested in, much more active than New York. You know, it's a smaller place. Poetry was more prominent overall within the cultural life of San Francisco at that time. The nature of the magazine wasn't based anywhere, and we also had very important connections to Canadian poetry. Steve McCaffrey, who was in Toronto, was an active co-conspirator, and the people in Vancouver, also important, had spent some time there in the early 70s, where I had met Robin Blazer. So, and then the later group that sort of started up the Kootenai School of Writing, readers, and we exchanged stuff. And also in Montreal, people like Nicole Broussard were sort of part of our circle of exchange. And in the United States, Washington, D.C. was also very important. Concentration of poets, but I think as important as those main big cities, I just mentioned the major poetry cities, with the exception of Chicago, in North America, I think it was individual people who weren't in any of those cities that could also participate fully through the magazine and the related poetry magazines, and also the international component, because language always had a very strong international readership, which has grown over the years. And that international readership recognized that at least, and I think perhaps more so than other magazines in our circle, language was particularly not focused on just the New American poetry. It was not just U.S. Centered, and we were more interested in the European avant-garde poetry traditions. Also connection to visual arts and to the other arts in New York and elsewhere. So there was a lot of points of entry for people for that magazine. And part of the magazine was set up almost as a network that would that excerpted stuff and connected with a range of things that weren't otherwise connected, that didn't necessarily have anything to do with, in the narrow sense, what we were doing, but Bruce and I were interested in. And I should also mention, very importantly, British poetry, especially people in London who were very active, and we had a whole British issue, and actually Chris Cheek edited a full issue that was just list of British small press, and the addresses and so on, then to try to get information to bring the alternative tradition there, often beleaguered, into kind of visibility and relationship to us. So that was another important part of our connection to UK as well. In New York, for example, in one of our early issues, we excerpted a theater program, a manifesto of Richard Foreman, who Bruce and I liked very much. Now, Richard Foreman didn't really know anything about us. He was a little bit older, and this was early on in our work. But through that, he became very interested and very happy to have been included. And I have worked with them all the years since. So that's something that I think there's a deep connection between what Forman is doing and what we were interested in doing in language. But it wouldn't have been apparent. It wasn't like it was a social or any other kind of connection. It was just a kind of creating affiliations, almost more like curating something. In retrospect, it looks like it was a more of a pre-existing aesthetic and group, but I would say that it was much more of an editorial and curatorial project that brought things together that were disparate, but that had a shared, certain aspects of a shared aesthetic, a shared approach to poetry, including especially what I called it, a book I edited a few years after we ended Language, The Politics of Poetic Form. So I really wanted to take a look at how forms and styles of poetry had an ideological and political import to them, not just the content, not just what you were saying, but the way you were saying it, the style. And also I'd add, since we were talking about the material practice of distribution and production, that those things also are political, where stuff is published, how it creates community and circulation. I've always thought the small press was, the small press of poetry has remained a very vibrant area of the exchange of ideas and of the free press in the United States, because while commercial publishing, of course, is also part of the free press and the most visible part, commercialization itself is limits what people can say, how they can say it, and who they reach. So non-commercial publishing, and publishing that's non-commercial in the sense not that it hopes if it's successful that it will become commercial, but that recognizes its permanent non-commerciality, creates different kinds of discussion, and that's what we were interested in. Much more on the margins of the dominant culture, perhaps much more at the center of the aesthetic and political thinking in the culture.
Right. So essentially, you see yourself overtly as oppositional. As the
absolutely yes, and that was very. Now some of us become. I've had gotten like me. I have a job at a University of Pennsylvania, So have a different kind of relationship to the kind of mainstream institutions than I had at the time we were doing language. Most of the people when we were doing language were very peripheral to any institution at all. And that was, part of our opposition. Now, certainly we're disconnected from any of the main institutions of poetry production and legitimation. What I called at that time, and would still call official verse culture. I think you could be oppositional, inside large institutions too. I don't have that view that one has to be dispossessed of any kind of institutional connection to be oppositional. But yes, for sure. And oppositionality was a matter also of the forms that we wrote in, including this in language. Of course, Language magazine was supporting a practice of poetry, so it would be true of poetry too, but within prose that did not follow kind of traditional plot-driven expository styles, which to me have always felt extremely restricting. It's not that they're bad, there's a lot of great stuff written that way, but then they become dominant, you can only write in that way. It limits the kinds of expression that are possible. So part of our oppositionality was in terms of the style of the essay writing itself.
Well, and what I think clearly, if you think about the context of poetry at that time, what differentiates language is the combination of theory and practice. Because there were lots of, was thinking about that while you were talking about the network effect, the kind of organizing ethos that the magazine had, it was defining a particularity of stance and vision and practice in a way that was different, I think, and that in significantly different by being consciously aware of theory and practice at the same time.
Right, and this was a huge, an explicit issue at the time. of what the relation of theory to practice was. There's another aspect to it, which was historical. We were very interested in not putting forward simply what we liked at the present moment, but rather in going into the past and putting forward a set of very important poets who we felt were which we wanted to devote more attention to, and also the certain philosophical works and ways of thinking that we thought were relevant to poetry. But the historical piece is a very important one. A lot of those poets that we championed have come more to the forefront than they were in the 70s, and that was part of what we were trying to do. I think that if you were involved in philosophy and theory, we would have seen much too poetic. If you were involved in poetry, we would have seemed too intellectual and too theoretical. And I'm quite interested in that particular margin on which I remain, on that the border point. There is a tremendous resistance to philosophical and theoretical thinking in the poetry community that I was engaged with in the 70s, as well as now, a kind of phobia to that kind of thought, that it would inhibit creativity. And in that sense, an implicit hierarchy, that kind of creative thought unbounded by a certain kind of intellectuality, was more in touch with the emotions and was better. And on the other side, the opposite view. And to me, both of those, I'm skeptical of both of those views. And we were interested in the set of thinkers who, many people are now and were then, but we were unusual in the poetry world in being interested in those European and American philosophers social critics that helped to for us to see what we were doing. So and also thinkers coming out of the left as well. So yes, so all of that. I'm not mentioning a whole lot of proper names, which I don't think is so significant. But I think a lot of the polemic against the kind of taint of these philosophical thinkers would seem odd now, because they're so accepted. It's hard to remember how how much poetry communities, and the ones I felt closest to, and the ones that I felt most distant from, had a kind of deep flirted with anti-intellectuality, and sometimes still do. It's not over. It takes a different form. And, of course, a lot of the formal innovation that we advocated, which was partly to loosen poetry up from a fixed idea of the lyric voice as being represented in a particular style, and allow for a multiplicity of styles and clashing of styles, as well as for poems that didn't pretend to be a person speaking, and didn't necessarily have a coherent plot, but established its expression and coherence through other means. Much of that pervades, Purge practice in 2013. And, there's been a huge sea change versus what there was in 78. So a lot of the style values that we were interested in, are much more commonly accepted, or certainly aren't viewed as being heinous as they were in the 70s. At the same time, those styles, this is one of the kind of things that is easy to miss, and of course from my point of view, as everything I'm saying is, but I never was interested in a particular kind of style. It's not like you write in one way. You write disjunctively versus conjunctively. This is either good or bad. There's nothing good about any particular style. But it's rather the thinking about what the style means that's significant, and the pushing back against received ideas that you need or have to write in one way regardless of who you are, where you're coming from, or what your point in time is. So it was rather to open up that issue of what style was as being a choice that was important, not advocating the single poetic style, which is not to say that there weren't a lot of, you know, the new emerging styles of the 70s that were very important and that did have a kind of, you know, mark to them that you can see and that I liked as well. But it was never those stylistic choices that were significant. And I think that probably was what was most difficult to take about the approach that Language Magazine took, because it's become, you know, it's almost like being unreligious in a way. You know, it's like it's not being monotheistic. You know, have one thing you adhere to, which somebody could disagree with, because it questions ideas of sincerity and authenticity, clarity, truth, which are important to, you know, many people and to many poets in terms of what they think are the core values of what they're doing.
Well, and do you feel like, I mean, it seems like Language, in doing what you just described doing, which was to talk about different style in a different way, you got identified, particularly the magazine, the group of poets around it, as a school, quote, you know, with the quotes around the word school, which
right.
I don't think you set out to do.
Well, I think that that's true. And there's a problem with either response to what you're saying. So that's the problem, is I'm of two minds about everything. That's both the exhilaration and the problem. You don't want to deny that there was collective action, the value of collective action, or partisanship around a set of values that people agree on. In the case of the 1970s, I think that there was a lot of the agreement had to do with not liking certain things or wanting to open things up. There wasn't an agreement on a set of principles or how to write and so on, but still, that's still was a... was a tendency or you could say, as you said earlier, conversation, a collective conversation. People were involved in it, but there are certain, you know, values that we had, certain interests we had in common toward certain poets historically versus others, toward philosophical approaches and so on and so forth. And being against certain kind, you know, I'd say being against certain normative constraints and standardization in poetry or in language practice in general. One of those views that I held very strongly then and do now is against the concept of school or even group as a tight-knit group of people who have the same principles, put forward the same thing, and were exclusive in their mutual support. So how you would describe that is to me more complicated. People tended not to identify with the idea that they were part of a school or that they could be identified by any, you know, single term. But that itself is the kind of identification, of course, and it represents a kind of anti-identitarian perspective around groups and movements, and which is uncommon. So it would still single you out in terms of the ideological spectrum of poets' views.
Exactly. So, do you feel like Language as a magazine, despite your desire? I mean, certainly you didn't feel like you were in what you would call a school, but because it acted as a kind of beacon, you know, as a point.
Well, a beacon is good. I like a beacon, or, you know, it's also the funny double sense of standard too, like just holding up a standard as a rallying point. Although in this case, against standardization, I'd say Barrett Wadden has liked the term language school. He always uses that. So I think even within those of us most intimately involved, there are opposite views about this, and that to me is very telling. But still, of course, it operates in many ways similar to the way a movement does, and of course, by school, people mean different things. I mean, simply the New York School of Poets or Painters, I mean, there's a lot of difference, you know, oppositionality is true friendship, or Black Mountain is not a coherent principle of those, you know, kind of immediately, you know, prior constellations. I'm always conscious of people who say, I'm against group thinking, and it's the individual, and groups leave people out. I think that group thinking is what language is. So it's not so easy to say you're against it.
It's right. Language is an agreement. That's right.
Well, because it's a communal thing. But I'm not right. Unsympathetic to those views, is all I would say. Although I scratch my head about all views. But I mean, one of the things that I was interested in, and other individuals, was bringing people who were relatively isolated and not recognized, you know, into some recognition, creating some way of understanding what that work is. So I think the great, wonderful irony of some of the poets who emerge from our context, who are to me remain among the most compelling, are people who are often said, well, they really weren't part of that group, they were skeptical and so on, but they, from my point of view, they were central. You know, like Susan Howe or Leslie Scalpino, Mae Burstenberger, might seem to some people peripheral because of their own attitudes toward that, but that would just make them more central to me, and always have, in terms of what kind of poetry I want. So for me, that demarcation point is very interesting, but has to be questioned as to what kind of context is created. And if you go back to what Bruce and I were doing as a curatorial project, in a way we were having a show of people who were quite eccentric. So it's in a way it's like having you can have a group, but if it's a group of all people who are extremely eccentric within American poetry, they're iconoclastic and they're going to push against, you know, one another's views. And that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in eccentricity and the iconoclastic and extreme language practices. So that is, and I think it's possible to make a, you know, to talk about that, to give a historical context to it, a philosophical context. But it's a different kind of cohesion than if, you know, by its very nature, it's about non-cohesiveness.
Right. No, I think that's important, I think, to think about, you know, as I think a lot of times magazines or presses are looked at as an expression of an aesthetic, and whether it's promoted by an individual or a group, but it still is the presentation is, or in production is the mode, and then the idea is that an audience participates in it by consumption, whereas what I think you're talking about, having that in its essence, you are not presenting a unified body of work, but the conversational or the kind of oppositional within the context that you'd created within the magazine
right.
itself.
Yeah, and I think you said that in an absolutely precise, useful way, because that would also be analogous to the poetics of the work itself, you see. So therefore, the structure and the work itself. And in that sense, you know, to take the opposite view against what I'm saying, because again, I'm always wanting to be of three minds about things. Of course, how you frame something, if you're a publisher, if you're an editor, if you write essays, if you're a teacher, as I am, you still get to frame things. Framing is fundamental. And does change things. And framing always leaves things out and gives significance to those things which you create the frame so that they can be seen. There's no way around that except to recognize that it's a provisional process, and the only way to create alternatives is to create alternative frames. But the issue of the significance of framing is part of what was contested in the 70s and now. Because I'd say it's like the politics of poetic form. The framing, the structure, the style choices are what you determine. And in poetry in particular, we have a greater freedom to mess with the framing, the horizontal control, the vertical control, the noise factor, and so on, because of the fact that it's not commercial. It doesn't have to reach a certain market level, which might require different choices, if that was your goal. Poetry's goal is really more to explore the formal dimensions of verbal language and the relation of framing and style and form to meaning, then you get something, you know, sort of closer to the, you know, the area that I operate in. But having said that, that's going to bring certain things to the fore as being significant, and it's going to make other things that might seem significant based on other values seem unimportant. So, you know, I'm not trying to pull away from the significance of the choices and the framing around specific values.
Right. No, and I think, so do you, I mean, this is maybe, I don't know maybe whether this is a good question or not, but did you and Bruce consciously have antecedents in mind, you know, of others who had preceded you that you thought of as not necessarily models, but maybe conceptual workings that would make sense.
You probably don't mean our own work as poets, but rather the kind of editorial process.
Yeah, as editors and publishers of a loosely called magazine, because you know whatever it is, it may not be called a magazine at some point. But
yes, it's a good question. It is a good question. Well, I'm not sure I can easily answer, which is why it's a good one. For one thing, I think that we were suspicious of a lot of the more manifesto-driven European avant-garde art movements from the past that had too narrow a sense of what the principles were. I'd sort of gone through that because that was sort of, you know, fundamental to me, to not have a kind of a principle-driven set of constraints, or for that matter, in American modernism with the pounds, a few don'ts, which always could be reversed. But nonetheless, those were, powerful models around the objectivist issue of poetry in 1932 that Zukofsky edited would be one. I think that probably the most obvious and tangible one for us in the mid-70s was a Russian formalist, futurist, whose work was just becoming available to us, the people around Plednikov, Krushnik, Mayakovsky, Shlavsky, and then the painters, Goncharova, Popova, Olochenko, that they collaborated with. So those set of people and the book art that they did, and the Zaun poems, and the collaborations, and the desire to take poetry, especially the visual arts, sort of out of the museum, and the politics, the conception that could be connected to some kind of social transformation. That was very exciting to read about and to feel connected to. So I would say of the 20th century art movement, that would have been the principal one. But I think most of us involved with with Language Magazine, beyond Bruce Sondheim, who contributed and whose work we were interested in, would have all been very close readers of the New American poetry, and of which there are conflicting views within that. But I mean, and of course, I became very close with Robert Creeley, working with him. But a quick graph that made an enormous impression on me. So that in a way, a quick graph is a good example of the kind of thing that I'm talking about, at least from that generation. And Robin Blazer was really remarkably not connected up with anybody other than Jack Spicer and Robert Duncan. He was a school of those three, and it became a kind of triangle, very involved with one another. But still, he was a very powerful influence on my thinking about the New American poetry, my knowledge about that. I think a lot of our models when you're young are negative, so there are many things that I like, but I didn't like the way that they were edited. I think the other thing, though, in addition to Creeley's A Quick Graph and the Russian formalists, would have been Rothenberg's anthologies, and I should have mentioned that first. So that would have been the most important. Actually, for me, I mean, on a practical level, I put that in number one. I'm saying it last. Technicians of Sacred made a huge impression on me. And I was in touch with Jerry right away before in the early 70s, as was Bruce Andrews, as was Ron Solomon. And The Revolution of the Word, his anthology, Modernist, this was a very important. That's very closely connected to the sort of historical a piece of what language was about, very overlapping set of poets that he was advocating for there. So, that would have been, you know, obviously. And we had Jerry Rosen McDermott write about his anthology practice in language. But the idea, as he says when he writes about the anthology, that you're really creating a collage when you're making the anthology. So you're not really trying to represent some external reality in a historically correct fashion, but actually creating a collage that allows for an experience and raises ideas and concerns. I think that was our sense of how we would edit. That's why we kept the pieces down so short. 500 words is very, very short. We would take whole books. I remember going sentence for sentence through some books and just picking sentences that I liked one after the other and then publishing that as a sort of excerpt of that book, as a sort of review or notice of the book. Very polemical way to deal with somebody else's work, so like taking the parts that you like, but that also allowed me to, you know, articulate some relationship to the work and why I thought it was important that the longer works themselves couldn't quite do. We were obsessed with excerpting in language, often in a way that I'm surprised that I'd be taken aback to do that now, but that's fine. We just would go and take a book and do that, and then just publish it within context
right.
The author.
Right, that's a
I would say almost all the authors that we did that to appreciated that we were interested in that dialogue.
Right. And didn't consider it appropriation.
I remember Eric Mottram, I did his whole Toward Design and Poetry, and just, you know, a full-length book, and, you know, 500 words, and I think he was shocked that I did that. But then we became friends. He appreciated that it was a real engagement with the book. And it was also a commentary. I mean, it's like with a review, you could have negative things and positive things. It's just, to me, it was a quick way of writing, of putting forward what was vital in something. And also, and, you know, this was the kind of, you know, arrogance of youth, sort of dismissing what you didn't like.
Right.
So, you know, you have that view, and I think that actually created a intensity to the magazine that really was crucial.
Well, I remember reading it in those days and thinking that, you know, I was just amazed, constantly amazed at the way you would present things that I hadn't thought about before or had thought about but hadn't recognized. And I think that was valuable even for people who were not necessarily practicing the same poetics, but to see that structure at work, you know, I think it was very powerful. I'm really glad you mentioned Rothenberg, because I think that his, you know, seeing yourself in the tradition or in the line of his work as an anthologist is really important. I think it's, you just made me think how unrecognized in a lot of ways his anthology work is. I mean, it's recognized because those anthologies are so powerful, but just the practice itself maybe deserves, I've been thinking about contacting Jerry.
I completely agree with you, and I think my mode of teaching, which I didn't really, you know, start to teach many years after we finished language, you know, also it extends out from that what the experience of a class is really to create an exhibition. Or I think going back to the whole issue of the construction of Language Magazine as an exhibition or a collage or a curatorial project, part of that has to do just with what you're saying was your reaction as a reader. I mean, you're interested in the set of things that you're familiar with, and you sort of bounce those up against contingently connected things. You can see when you move from, and we ordered, each issue was ordered, you know, by hand, and it was in alphabetical order or anything like that. There's no table of contents to any of the issues either, which now, once again, I love tables of contents and indexes. So we didn't have it. You have to read through the issues, and the new pieces began in the middle of the page. It would be hard to find what it was. You had to read it as each issue as a single work, And that, you know, abutted one idea to another. So there's the poetics of contingency there. I mean, that's a particular style. It wasn't rational. It wasn't funny for something that was sometimes viewed as being, you know, hyper-intellectual and theoretical. It's, in many ways, it's very anti-theoretical if you think of theory as a principle that exists outside and that everything is examples. It was much more a collage of juxtaposing points of view, but ones that had, you know, a connection, an associative connection, as you might have in a poem. And if you could get into that associative connection, yeah, so it would link up a whole range of things that you might otherwise not think were connected, but that turned out to be connected.
So I guess I have one more question for you. And this is an artificial question, but maybe useful for perspective purposes. So thinking about language as a magazine today, from your 35 years on, you know, how would you characterize it? Not as you would have then, but look, you know, as you, you know, today, what do you have a different view of it today than you did then?
Well, I think what I've just said in the last couple of minutes is the way I see it now, although I'm not sure I didn't see it then. I wouldn't have seen it quite as starkly as an aesthetic practice of collage that was a curatorial assembly. Although I knew that that's what it was, I think at the time, almost like a magician's trick, it looked like when you put these things together that they were already connected and that it had a more almost either conspiratorial aspect or that it was some pre-existing group of people who were putting something forward. And so the magic trick was sort of put this ensemble of things together and make it seem like it had that power, you know, connecting up to, in that sense, to see it more as a kind of, you know, create a constellation and much more even closely connected to poetic practice than I understood at the time, as I've gone on to create, you know, other poetic works along that principle.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. Well, I think this has been, for me, really interesting. I hope it's as interesting for others who might be listening. I think it's, you know, language was a very particular and singular operation, and I think it's really been good hearing you talk about it. So,
well, it's a pleasure talking to you, David, and I look forward to hearing the show when it's produced.
Well, I hope that will be soon. This has been Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Charles Bernstein about language, literally.